You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 312, Exodus Q&A, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
What's going on is we have 700 students in the Awakening School of Theology.
That's awesome.
Which, yeah, it's awesome, but it's a bit intimidating. I mean, I'm waiting for the avalanche of feedback to happen, and then we'll be scrambling. But you know, that's a good problem to have. So we'll just approach it as it comes. But we've got about 130. We're through our first week now. We had about 130 total live. Over two nights, Mondays and Thursdays, and then the rest are distance students. So, yeah, it's kind of blown up.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that is a good problem to have. And another good problem to have, Mike, is we're going to have three episodes of Exodus Q&A because that's how many questions we got sent in. So we got them whittled down to three episodes. So we're going to have part one, two, and three here, which this is the first part. We are officially done with Exodus, so that's good, but we got a mountain of questions to climb before we're official. So I hope you're ready for that.
Yep, we'll do our best.
Mike, we want to remind people we are going to have a 2020 Naked Bible Conference. It is going to be at the same place in Dallas, and it's August 15th. So August 15th this year.
Yeah. Yeah, and we know who the speakers are too, but I'm hemming and hawing about the fifth one here, so that's why we haven't released the names. But I'm gonna have to pull the trigger here shortly. So
yeah, and I'll put up. We'll start selling tickets here in a couple months. So, which is a month or two sooner than we've ever done it. So you'll have plenty of time to get tickets, and we'll let y'all know ahead of time. But we're at least 2 months away from selling tickets. But if you want to start planning now, for the conference, August 15th, 2020. And if you want to reserve tickets, I guess, Mike, I guess you can email me at treystrickland@gmail.com and I can go ahead and reserve you a ticket. Why not? So if you're that eager to come, I'm all about it. So I'll hook you up. So just let me know.
Yep. Trey's looking for things to do. So give him a little work to do.
I am not short of things to do. Let me tell you, people. And I apologize if I can't get back to your email, Mike. You probably respond better than I do in email because I can't get to them. I can't. So
well, that's a little frightening.
I'm sorry, but Mike, we've also got a cruise update. We've got I think about 62 people so far that's going to join us. So that's going to be a fun trip and plenty of room. So
yeah, room for more. 62 does not exhaust the block, so we can deal with more.
That's going to be an awesome cruise.
If I said Maury was coming along or the pugs, both pugs, and we'd leap to 100, I'm quite sure, but easy. I don't think they allow that.
Yeah. That turns it into a whole nother cruise. I don't know if we want to go there.
Right. But we need to do like a get together at a pug cafe in Japan. See, I now have a reason to go to Japan.
Do they have a pug cafe or just cats? I thought they just had like a cat.
There's a pug cafe. Okay. I've seen video of.
All right. Yeah, we've talked about this before. You've mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we should do that.
it's on my list of things to do. It's like way down toward the bottom
there.
That's right. Well, Mike, what's going on here? All of a sudden, I see a new Dr. Michael Heiser book popping up. What's going on here?
Oh, yeah. I did, I had done Reversing Hermon with Defender. And so the new one that's out is the first in, Lord willing, what will be a series on the Book of Enoch. So They were going to do this, I think, in March, but then they moved it up and started shipping this week. But it's a reader's commentary on the Book of Enoch. So the first volume is the Book of the Watchers, which is the first 36 chapters of the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is actually, it's kind of like the Bible in that it's comprised of separate books, you know, sections. At least scholars have labeled the sections that way. But the first 36 chapters is known throughout the academic world as the Book of the Watchers. So volume one of a reader's commentary on the Book of Enoch covers that material. And you ask, well, what's a reader's commentary? Well, the book is academic, but it is not a scholarly verse by verse, you know, drill down into every syllable, you know, type of commentary. A reader's commentary more or less just helps someone reading through the Book of Enoch to understand what in the world they're reading. So I will comment about words. I'll comment about original language stuff. And of course, the theological content. It's the relationship of the content to the Bible, that sort of thing. But it's like a handbook, you know, really. I don't say something about every verse or everything in each verse, but, you know, we try to pick, you know, significant things, especially as it relates to, you know, worldview theological content and its attachment to scripture. So yeah, first volume of that is out. For those, I've gotten a couple questions about this already, about the translation. I'm using the translation used in the commentary is that of Charles, his 1919 translation. And the reason we use that is because that's public domain. But I interact with the more recent scholarly translation by Nicholsberg and Vanderkam throughout the book. So we can't reproduce that translation without paying significant licensing fees and, you know, all those sorts of negotiations. So we start with Charles, and where the more recent translation, again, based on recent scholarship and textual study, where that matters for the content, for understanding the material, we certainly interact with that. So that's in a nutshell what it is, a reader's commentary on the Book of Enoch. First volume is the first 36 chapters, known as the Book of the Watchers.
And that's shipping already, right?
Yep. Yep. It's shipping now as we speak. Kind of nice they moved it up. Actually, somebody on Instagram alerted me to something about Amazon. I went up and looked, and then that popped into my screen. And I thought, wow, you know, I didn't expect that to be out there this fast. So I confirmed that. And, you know, Amazon had taken the pre-order thing off. And so it's shipping. You order it now, you'll get it very, very shortly.
And the Demons book is just right around the corner.
Yeah. Yes, that has not moved. That is firm. After three moves in the past, that will ship at the, you know, toward the end of April. That will not change.
All right. Good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Well, Mike, we've got several questions here.
I'm sure we got a good number of questions. So yeah, let's jump in.
All right. The first one's from Craig. I just finished listening to podcast number 259 on Exodus 2:11-25. As you were talking about the Midianites' connection to Abraham and the possibility that they knew of and worshiped the God of Abraham, I wondered if Moses was aware of that and intentionally chose Midianite territory to flee to. Though not impossible, it's difficult to imagine Moses just heading out to who knows where, as there were likely plenty of non-friendly people and inhospitable places he could have encountered. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it seems reasonable to think that the Hebrews in Egypt would have passed on the history of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob orally, and that that history would include Abraham's offspring, including the descendants of Midian. Midian was a son of Abraham and Keturah, according to Genesis 25:1-2. And if you look at Genesis 25, a few verses later in verses 5 and 6, when Abraham gave Isaac his inheritance, he also gave gifts to the sons of his concubines, one of which was Keturah, and, quote, sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the east country. So, you know, Midian would have been included in that sending away. And he's actually specifically mentioned in Genesis 25:4 as part of that. So, you know, I think, just generally speaking, you know, this is an oral culture. They have a strong, you know, oral history and tradition of their ancestors, especially, you know, Abraham and his offspring and the covenant with Yahweh. So I think it's reasonable, you know, given that contact, given, you know, again, the orality of the culture, and they had, there's no reason to think that they didn't perpetuate their own traditions. I mean, what, honestly, what ancient people just doesn't bother with their traditions? That's very common. So given all that, you know, and Moses' contact with the Hebrews in Egypt, I think Moses could have known of these traditions, at least in part. I think he would have heard, you know, something there. And so, you know, it makes sense, you know, that he would have gone to Midian thinking that he would perhaps encounter relatives. I think that's a reasonable thing to conclude.
Our next two questions are from Mike, and his first one is on the discussion on the location of Exodus 3 will most likely never reach a decisive conclusion. I am always very wary of translations resulting in cardinal directions from ancient texts because the people did not think that way. For instance, looking at the Leningrad Codex from scriptureforall.org, we see behind the wilderness instead of west. Any idea how behind the wilderness ends up being translated as west?
Well, you know, there's a couple things to say here. You know, ancient people certainly knew directions. You know, they were oriented east, so south is, you know, literally the right hand. If you're facing east, then your right hand would be pointed, you know, south, and that's how they would denote that direction. To the left would be north, and they also had the word Safon, which points to the, you know, the high mountains, again, to the left of someone facing east. So, I mean, they did have these things, you know, a sense of direction. So that I think we need to establish right away. The Leningrad Codex, the question references scriptureforall.org, the website. The Leningrad Codex doesn't actually say behind the wilderness or anything else in English. The Leningrad Codex is Hebrew. And that means, and this is a reference to, like, if people go up to the website and actually look at this, that means any English at that website is supplied by someone or something. And I'll get into what I mean by that in a bit. It's a gloss. It's a translation opinion. The Hebrew is achar midbar. And the second of those terms, midbar, is usually translated desert or wilderness in scripture and in all translations, really, in English. The preceding word, achar, is unusual in combination with ha midbar. So achar ha midbar. That phrasing is, you know, uncommon. ESV does translate it as west side. And the reality is that achar, you know, and the website had behind, in and of itself, that word glossed, you know, in English as behind really is meaningless. Behind what? I mean, you have to know behind what to even make any sense of it. So the answer to that question, behind what, or after what, achar, you know, typically means after as well. The answer would depend on what direction someone is traveling. So as to tell how one is moving toward the wilderness to get to a region behind it, okay, or beyond it, or you know, you pass that place after, you know, and then you get to the desert, so that place is behind you. You know, you have to know which way you're headed. And I think that's part of the ambiguity that the questioner, Mike, is getting at. ESV's West suffers from the same ambiguity. Again, it's a guess. The English, you know, choice there is going to be predicated on, you know, the translator's notion, the translator's opinion of what the starting point of the directional journey, you know, the path, what the starting point was and what the intended end point is. And that's going to give, you know, the semantic meaning to achar hamidbar in the translator's mind. That's just the way it is. The English in the website mentioned is certainly, I would say, auto-generated from a public domain source. So in other words, if you're going up to scriptureforall.org and you're looking at the transcription or the text, excuse me, of the Leningrad Codex, the Westminster Leningrad Codex there, and you see English there, that is not a translation. Those are English glosses that are drawn, you know, really sucked from some other source through a computer script. And this is what, you know, we did this at Logos all the time. In this case, and I think in most cases when you encounter this online, the source of the English glosses is going to be like Strong's Concordance or some Strong's tool, specifically because that's in public. They can use that and not be in licensing trouble. So people who create these sort of resources for free to put online domain, I mean, they have the computer savvy to dump the text into the computer, write a script that extracts the English and marries it to the Hebrew by lemma, or in Logos's case, we used word numbers, something called word numbers that we created to do the mapping. But that's how these things are put together. This is not a translation. So behind in that resource is not actually a translation. It's an English gloss, again, sucked in by means of a programming script written by the person or persons who created the web source. Nothing shifty in that. It's just how it's done. The phrase, again, achar midbar in Exodus 3:1 really means something like after the wilderness or after the desert. Okay? And this, you know, therefore provides no specific direction, for its actual meaning would depend on the starting point, some sort of contextual indicator as to what direction the person meant or the writer meant. Achar can certainly describe something in the West. There are passages that use that word, and those passages include more geographical context so that you can tell, you know, what direction is actually meant by this after terminology. For instance, Deuteronomy 11:30, and we just listen to this verse. Are they not beyond the Jordan west? There's our west, that west of the road toward the going down of the sun, in the land of the Canaanites who live in the Arabah, opposite Gilgal, beside the Oak of Moreh. I mean, look at all the geographical information in that verse. And you can tell after the road, west of the road. You can have a really good deduction as to what direction is indicated by the terminology there. But, you know, Exodus 3:1 doesn't give you that much. As far as Midbar goes, there's really no ambiguity there. It describes a wilderness or desert region dozens of times in the Hebrew Bible when that is quite evident in context. If you take all that to Exodus 3:1, a translation like west, you know, if we had the translator here, he would justify that translation in light of really two things. A, the location of Midian, which is pretty well known, juxtaposed with B, other references to the desert, to the Midbar, in near context in the book of Exodus, like Exodus 15:22. Let me just read that. Then Moses made Israel set out from the land or from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. So we know where the Red Sea's at, and based upon, you know, where Israel is at on that particular journey, you know, they're headed, you know, in a certain direction. They've made this or that turn. Again, your options are limited, but the point here is that the wilderness of Shur in relation to the Red Sea is also pretty well known. And even if you wonder, well, where exactly is that wilderness? You know that it is west of Midian because you know where Midian is. That's the easy part here, Midian itself, the area. So the wilderness of Shur, you know, you're going to get help there with other passages as well. I'm going to just open Harper's Bible Dictionary here and read something quick. The wilderness of Shur is a desert region somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula, okay, somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula, east of the present Suez Canal. It was inhabited by Ishmaelites. Genesis 25:18 was for a long period the home of Abraham. Genesis 20 verse 1. The Israelites during the Exodus entered it immediately after leaving the Red Sea, Exodus 15:22. The way to Shur, where the angel met Hagar, Genesis 16:7, is probably the desert track leading southward from Beer Sheva, along which Saul and later David pursued the Amalekites as far as Shur. That's 1 Samuel 15:7 and 27:8. So what Bible geographers do is they'll take, you know, references to places, and based upon, you know, other lots of passages, and what's going on in those passages, and the limitations of foot travel, and so on and so forth. I mean, and other geographical information in related passages. You know, when it comes to something like, you know, the wilderness of Shur, again, somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula. You know, that's relatively, sure, pardon the pun, it's relatively certain. But regardless, even if you can't pinpoint the exact place, latitude and longitude, where this wilderness is, it is west of Midian. So this is how, the translator would justify that translation in Exodus 3:1. It's not just guesswork. I mean, you go from the known and you try to extrapolate to the unknown. So according to Exodus 3:1, it could very quite easily be read as Moses leaving Midian, moving west, after which was the mountain of God, Horeb, or Sinai. And so Sinai would not be in Midian, if that is the proper reading. And that's a very ordinary reading. But it would be somewhere in the northern area of the Sinai Peninsula, reachable in 3 days after the crossing of the sea. And that takes us back to the problem, we covered in the podcast a lot, the problem of the half dozen or so references to Moses reiterating God's instruction. Things like, let us go 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to Yahweh, which sacrifice occurred at Sinai. So if we take those verses at face value, and we take Exodus 15:22 at face value, and Exodus 3:1 at face value, then Mount Sinai cannot be in Midian proper. It just can't. So, there you go. But I would agree, that, yeah, there's ambiguity in directional language, but it's not hopeless. I mean, there are places where, you do throw up your hands and it's like, who knows? But translators are working with lots of other geographical references when they try to translate a phrase like Akar Hamidbar. I mean, it's not just, hey, where do I want it to be? Or, let's flip a coin. I mean, it's not like that. It's a little bit better than that. And in some cases, it's a lot better than that.
All right. Mike goes on to say, this seems to be the same sort of place Paul liked to preach the gospel, where the people were not already a part of someone else's flock or seated with a lot of ideas that would need to be refuted. A place habitable, but not really all that prosperous. This is just like where most common people live. It is still the perfect place for God to show up, make himself manifest, and commission more agents. Why can't it be both the place where God chose to speak to Moses and the place where he speaks to us today? Kind of like the letters of the churches at the beginning of the book of Revelation. Jesus speaks in the midst of the lampstands, but not necessarily from the pulpits.
Yes, I'll confess this is a little hard to follow because I don't really know what the point is, because God does speak through people in places that are, highly populated or not highly populated. He also meets people in either place. So I don't know how you're putting percentages on these sorts of things, and I don't even know if that's the point. I mean, in Paul's case, Paul goes to cities all the time. He goes to synagogues all the time. I mean, there's certainly a lot to argue about in synagogues. I mean, that's basically what Paul was looking for. He wanted to debate, So Paul always went first to the Jews. Certainly they were part of a flock, part of a group, part of a congregation, a synagogue. And again, typically got thrown out. Then he went to the Gentiles. But, as Paul says over and over and over again, not just in Romans, but, the Jew first, also to the Gentile, the barbarian. But he definitely goes to places that are populated and prosperous major cities. Ephesus is the one that sticks out. Corinth. I mean, so I don't really follow the trajectory of the question. I don't think it's sort of parsable that way, or Paul's activity is really parsable in those terms. At any rate, Paul's modus operandi in my mind has little to do with the meaning of the Hebrew lemmas back in Exodus. So yeah, I don't think we can really abstract it like that.
Rebecca has a thought on Exodus 3. If Moses was circumcised at birth and then placed in Pharaoh's house post-weaning, it would explain how he would have known he was ethnically Hebrew, yet be ignorant of Hebrew culture, religion, and the name Yahweh. Exodus 4:24-25 tells us his son was circumcised, but does not mention Moses and circumcision. Am I assuming he already was, but his son was not, as it was not customary for Midianites or Egyptians?
Yeah, on one hand, you can make, those assumptions. Let's just start with Moses being circumcised at birth and placed in Pharaoh's house, post-weaning. I mean, we'd have to assume, you know, in turn, that Moses remembered those sorts of details from the time he was 2 or 3 years old, because that's when you wean a child, or a couple, you know, 2, 3 years old. So he has that time with his natural mother, and then he is raised in Pharaoh's household. So is he really going to retain conversations from being 2 or 3? Well, you know, I've had 4 kids and I have my own life experience to draw on. I don't remember anything when I was 2 or 3. So I think there's some doubt there. And even if he noticed, you know, the physical nature of his circumcision as he grew up, you know, mommy, what, you know, I mean, would he even ask the question? He might, you know, if he looked at other boys and then looked at himself, why am I different? You know, would the Egyptian woman have told him, well, it's because you're really a Hebrew and you don't really belong here. You know, you're not my natural. So, I mean, would she really say that? I don't know. You know, again, I think there's at least some doubt to that. It's also interesting that, yeah, Moses' son is circumcised in Exodus 4, 24 and 25, but he hadn't done it when the boy was 8 days old, according to the traditions of the patriarchs. So if he had known that information, why didn't Moses do it? I mean, that's part of the reason why God is angry. So there's a disconnect there too. You know, the reality is we don't know whether Moses was circumcised or not. You can build a case that it's reasonable to think he was. You can build a case that it's reasonable to think he wasn't. It's uncertain. We just aren't told. You know, either option could work in the overall narrative in different ways. You know, we can suggest that Moses was, again, assuming that his parents obeyed the patriarchal tradition of Genesis, you know, passages like Genesis 16 and 17. Specifically, I'll just read one. Genesis 17:12. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money, from any foreigner who is not of your offspring. Okay, this is, you know, God speaking to Abraham, and Abraham, of course, passes that on to those in his household. Well, if Moses didn't do this to his own son at 8 days, is it possible that his own parents didn't do it? I don't know. I mean, again, you can make arguments either way. But again, you know, would he have really learned that at home? You know, he's not going to remember anything 2 or 3 years old. But if they didn't do it, then he wouldn't be different than the Egyptian boys, and the question would have never come up. So, you know, we just don't know. You know, not circumcising him wouldn't have concealed his identity either. We talked about this earlier in the podcast because, you know, when Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the Nile and finds this baby in a little basket, what Egyptian would do that? I mean, what Egyptian mother would? You know, oh, I got to hide my kid. You know, I got to put him in the knot. I mean, nobody's going to do that. And if you want to kill the kid, you just throw him in. You know, he's crocodile bait. You know, obviously, whoever did this, you know, she's reasoning, wanted to preserve the child alive. And what children are under, you know, threat of death? Well, that would be the Hebrews. I mean, you don't have to have a circumcised child even in that case. Pharaoh's daughter is going to know that this is not an Egyptian child. So the circumcision doesn't really help there either. So, you know, it's an uncertainty and an ambiguity that just goes in with the story.
Rebecca also wants to know if a possible biblical precursor example of assumed circumcision as a factor could be when Joseph cleared the room and then makes himself known to his brothers. In privacy, he could have used the sign of his circumcision as a proof of his identity. Of course, this is not explicitly stated, but circumcision is 1, commanded of Abraham and descendants, 2, congruent with biblical Hebrew culture, and 3, a logical reason for what Moses did and did not know.
You know, I think it's clear that Joseph, you know, was circumcised because of the Shechem, you know, incident, you know, when his, the whole, you know, Hamor and Shechem incident, when the men of the city have to be, you know, circumcised to marry Jacob's, you know, marry into Jacob's family and so on and so forth. So I think that's part pretty clear, but I don't think that Joseph exposed himself to, you know, prove his identity here. You know, to me, I think, you know, he says, I am Joseph. I mean, that's actually part of that scene in the story. I am Joseph. So he makes his identity known by telling them his name. And if they had any doubts, the fact that he was Joseph would have explained the oddity that happened earlier, you know, at the meal when they, Joseph's brothers, you know, quote, sat before him. This is Genesis 43:33. They sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at one another in amazement. So they're actually seated in the correct order of their birth. That's why his brothers are kind of looking at each other going, this is kind of weird, you know, because we're all occupying positions at the table in the correct birth order. So when Joseph, you know, later on says, I'm Joseph, that would have made sense. Of course, he would have known who they were and put them in the correct order. And Joseph in that scene also tells them what happened to him, their brother Joseph, sold into slavery. How would he have known that unless he was really Joseph? So I don't think we need to have Joseph exposing himself to certify his identity. He just knows things that only Joseph would know. Of course, you know, none of this is explicitly stated, but I don't think we need the circumcision element to make sense of the revelation that Joseph, you know, gives to his brothers.
Joe asks, Dr. Heiser has mentioned that Moses might not have known the name of God or who he was at the time of Moses' calling. This has been fascinating to think about and makes the story of Exodus even more miraculous and shows God's grace in a new light that I had never, ever considered. There seems to be three parts in the Bible that show Moses might have been connected to the Hebrew community, aware of who he was, aware of the Hebrew spiritual traditions, and familiar with the name of God. One, when he killed the Egyptian. Two, after God caused Moses at the burning bush. And three, if Moses was raised in all the wisdom of Egyptians, Acts 7:22, would that include knowledge and understanding of the Hebrew belief system? I thought I would ask for clarification and insight or see if I've missed something with my novice understanding.
Yeah, I've already said I think it's reasonable to think that Moses knew something of the patriarchal heritage. Again, that he quite conceivably, you know, could have heard oral tradition of the Hebrews. We have to really essentially believe that after he's released, you know, at weaning, you know, he goes to live in Pharaoh's household, that sometime later, he would have had contact with somebody in his family. I mean, it's reasonable, again, it's not stated, but it's reasonable to think that they would have sort of followed his progress. I mean, they obviously know who he is, and that this sort of information could have come down to him. If he knew, and I think this much he might know as a 2 or 3 year old, his name that would have been ringing around in his head is not an Egyptian word. Necessarily. So that might have prompted a question. We just don't know, but it's reasonable to think that he knew something about where he had come from. You know, we aren't told exactly how he knew that, but in the scene when, you know, he sees, you know, the fight, you know, going on, and he winds up killing the Egyptian, again, he understands the implications of what has just happened and the fact that he's killed an Egyptian and so on and so forth. And what the, you know, the Israelites, the Hebrews there say to him, you know, when that's going on. So, you know, the narrative certainly suggests that he had some knowledge. I don't think we need to, you know, really affirm that and then speculate, you know, to very, very specific knowledge. I don't think we're able to do that. It's probably a better way of saying that, but presuming that he knew of the identification ethnically. He did know something about his heritage, but we can't be sure of the extent or the specifics of that knowledge. And when it comes to the burning bush, you know, there's this whole issue of what happens at the bush, the revelation of the name later on, and they're still at the burning bush scene, or at least, you know, the same conversation, or still on Sinai anyway, when God, you know, mentions Aaron, Moses' brother. And of course it raises the question, well, how did Moses know who his brother was if he was completely isolated from his family while he was in Egypt? Well, again, he probably wasn't. That's a worthwhile observation. It lets us know again that Moses did know something of his heritage. Now we have an extra detail. He probably knew his family members because he there isn't any other explanation given for why he would know this person, Aaron. But honestly, that's all it really tells us. It doesn't say that he and Aaron sat down and talked theology. It doesn't tell us anything like that. All that we really can discern from that, you know, passage is that he did know he had a brother and his brother's name was Aaron. You know, and I'll rabbit trail a little bit here. We tend to think that if Moses knew who, you know, knew Aaron, that they are going to talk theology because Aaron, you know, is the high priest. Well, Aaron's not the high priest back at the Exodus, you know, Exodus 3 and 4. You know, Aaron was a Levite, but we can't read any specific religious knowledge into that for Aaron and his family because it would only be after the Exodus that he's made a Levite. He's made a, or not a made a Levite, but he's made the high priest. And after that, it's the golden calf incident that the rest of Aaron's people, the Levites, the Levitical tribe, that they become involved in the priestly service, you know, serving the tabernacle, probably a better way to say that. So all those things, that body of knowledge, as best we can tell, is later in their story. And there's no indication that Levi as a tribe or that Aaron and his sons as people were chosen because they had special knowledge. And when we talked about the golden calf, the reason, the rationale for the Levites, you know, the tribe of Levi being linked to the service of the tabernacle is their choice, you know, to follow Moses and refuse, you know, to worship, you know, the golden calf, to worship Yahweh in an aberrant way. Now you could say, well, doesn't that suggest they knew something about Yahweh? You know, that he shouldn't be, you know, made, they shouldn't make images. Well, again, the image command is only given at Sinai. Again, we can't just assume and retroject the details of the Sinai law and these events that occur at Sinai or a little bit after. We can't move those back into the past and put them in Aaron's skull like he just knew all this stuff. There's no way to really justify that from the text. So we don't really know what Aaron knew, but at the very least, we know that he knows who Moses is, and Moses knows he's his brother. So it tells us he wasn't completely cut off, you know, from the Hebrews in Egypt. Again, as a prince of Egypt, you know, he probably could move in and out of the Hebrews as he wanted to, you know, being careful to observe certain customs and whatnot, you know, to be a good Egyptian and so on and so forth. But again, he would have known something, but we just don't know exactly what he actually knew.
Joe has another question on the control of the Egyptians had over the Hebrews prior to Moses. Would the Hebrews be allowed to leave as Aaron did to visit Moses? I always assumed they were more or less prisoners, but in looking at the story again, Aaron is either allowed to leave or escape secretly to visit Moses. Is there any historical information that shows if the Hebrews were prisoners or they were more or less allowed to leave, except for large numbers?
Yeah, we actually aren't told anything as to how Aaron came to meet Moses. You know, the whole passage puts forth the idea of divine appointment. So we know that however that happened, God was behind the scenes, you know, working those events together. God was in the details there. But the narrative just doesn't tell us what God did to put Aaron in that place at that time. So again, we're just not left with, you know, answers to these sorts of questions. And we can create, you know, sort of reasonable scenarios, but that doesn't mean they're correct. Doesn't mean they're hopelessly wrong either. But I think we just need to be careful about what we can say and what we can't say. And, you know, unless the text tells us, we don't have to read anything, you know, like super extraordinary, like, you know, God picked him up in the air and, you know, threw him over there. So, I mean, I don't think, and the questioner's, you know, not doing that. I'm just saying that there are others out there in internet land, Bible study, that they will draw conclusions like that and just sort of make Aaron like Elijah, you know, in flying chariots or something. You know, if we're not given details in the text, my inclination, as you well know, if you listen to this podcast, my inclination is to not speculate. And if I do speculate, I'll tell you that that's what I'm doing.
Andy has a couple of questions, and his first question is, in the Exodus 3 episodes, why take Yahweh from the South traditions literally, and then say in other places that God is outside space and time?
Well, we take them literally because the Israelites are embodied humans. They carry the ark on real ground. They go to real places. You can visit them today. Again, some of them with very high certainty. There's no reason to not take the Yahweh from the South traditions literally, because those places are real and exist. And frankly, all those things make sense, you know, in the narrative. There's just no reason to think anything else. You know, other places that God is outside space and time. Well, the Israelites can be traveling to real places, and that doesn't impinge upon God's omnipresence or the fact that he is separate from the material world. Those two things are not, you know, linked, as though they create tension with one another. So I don't think that we have a problem here at all.
And the second question is in Exodus 4. Why read priesthood of Aaron into the text when there is nothing in the text about the priesthood of Aaron? True, Aaron is functioning as an intermediary for Moses, but in his role as high priest of Israel, he serves as an intermediary for all of Israel, not just Moses. I'm not sure how you can talk about the priesthood of Aaron based on this text. Priesthood language just isn't there, even if a primitive function is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question, you know, because the priesthood of Aaron isn't mentioned in Exodus 4. You know, and when we talked about this in relation to Exodus 4, you know, I did note that this is a proposal. It's a speculation. It's really done because of what follows. In other words, how Aaron is cast in a leadership role right after this episode. You know, right after Exodus 4, you get to Exodus 5. You know, there's Aaron with Moses, again, as sort of the right-hand person, and really in some cases actually being in the forefront. So because that happens, it raises the question of, well, you know, how does he get to do that? So it's really, again, based upon what follows. You know, you could also say that that's anomalous, because there's no call narrative for Aaron like there was with Moses, and that's true. You know, the fact is that's how he's cast, though. I mean, so we don't get a call narrative for Aaron like we do with Moses. Again, certainly that's the case. But it's also the case that he's there with Moses. You know, there's two, you know, leadership figures now instead of one. And so scholars look for Aaron's history in the narrative, again, which once, you know, all the things that Aaron winds up doing is observed, and the question is asked, well, how does he get to do that? I mean, what, especially if there is no call narrative, you know, what, why does he occupy this status? And that puts us back in Exodus 4, which is his, you know, appearance in the story. Then, you know, and so scholars would then ask, you know, well, is there something about what happens in Exodus 4 that relates in some way, or perhaps accounts for Aaron's function from that point forward? Again, especially when before Exodus 4, the focus is clearly Moses alone. And again, he's the only one that gets this calling. And the only thing that emerges is Moses' obstinate unbelief. And so God, you know, accommodates Moses. He doesn't just obliterate him or just say, well, forget it, I'm going to go get somebody else. So instead of doing that, God says, okay, I'm going to give you Aaron here, your brother, and he'll be your helper. Now, none of that, you know, none of the reasoning there is spelled out in verse form. That's true, but it's a reasonable way to account for the data points, both what happens later, and then asking, where'd that come from? Like what happened here? And again, you go back to the initial appearance of Aaron on the scene. And, you know, that's what you get. It's in the context of Moses hemming and hawing and, you know, refusing and not believing and so on and so forth. And, you know, basically expressing self-doubt and lack of faith. And so God, again, instead of just removing Moses, says, okay, we'll bring Aaron into the picture here. And, you know, it's only later that he becomes a priest, but he is put into a leadership role. So that's why scholars go that direction.
All right. Cody has a question about the latter portion of Exodus 4. And he's interested to hear Dr. Heiser's take on the Septuagintal account. There are a couple of major differences. For one, in the Septuagint, Zipporah fell at his feet, traditionally the feet of the angel of the Lord, rather than putting the foreskin anywhere in particular. Next, her statement in the Septuagint is, the flow of blood of my son's circumcision is stopped. From my inexperienced reading, this could also possibly say, the blood of my son's circumcision is set, placed to or in front of somebody, presumably Moses or the Lord. Is there a Hebrew witness for this variant? Why mightn't we favor the Masoretic rendering in this particular passage from a text critical perspective?
Yeah, the first thing to just sort of mention and get out of the way here is that the Septuagint portion of this does not mention the angel of the Lord. That's made up. that's just a tradition. There's nothing in the Septuagint that gets the angel of the Lord into the passage, you know, and the same would go for the Masoretic text as well. And as we jump into the rest of it, it's actually a good place to promote the Lexham English Septuagint. I mean, for those of you who want to know, you know, what the Septuagint says here or there, there is a free public translation in English of the Septuagint by Brenton, Brenton, that you can find online in PDF. You can also find the NETS New English translation of the Septuagint online in PDF. But if you want to buy one to hold in your lap, there is now a New English translation of the Septuagint that Lexham Press, the publishers of Unseen Realm, has created. They created it from the data in Logos Bible software. That's where the Lexham English Septuagint originated in digital form. But now it's available as a book. You can get it on Amazon. So if you're wondering, there you go. This is an interesting question because, yeah, in the Septuagint, both in the Rolfe's edition of the Septuagint and Sweet, his edition, we have the same Greek. We have pros epesen pros tous podos, fell at the feet. Okay, it's not his feet. It's fell at the feet. Now, if you went to a critical apparatus for, you know, the tools and resources for doing textual criticism in the Septuagint, namely the Gerdigan Septuagint series, that resource is going to tell you that some manuscripts do insert autu, the word his, there. So some manuscripts do have fell at his feet, but the major editions of the Septuagint do not. So it just depends. I mean, you can have an English translation. I don't know what NETS has here. If they adapted that variant, they would include the pronoun there. Maybe they have, you know, fell at his feet. I don't know. But again, the two sort of most common go-to text forms of the Septuagint that scholars use today do not have it. So the term itself, you know, let's just say it this way. You know, that other than the way it renders a particular verb, the verb in the Septuagint, you know, pros epesen, okay, fell. Other than that word, the Septuagint here is really very, very close to the Masoretic text. And you could actually argue that even that translation choice, one of the Greek terms for fall, that could still conceivably be a rendering of the same Hebrew as we find in the Masoretic text. Now, some of this doesn't really translate well to audio, but I'm gonna give this a shot here. The verb choice that the Septuagint has here, that Greek lemma could be translated as strike against, like in an attack or you know, reaching out and hitting. It could also be translated touching or embrace. You know, maybe the semantic nuance of grab here, because the feet in the Masoretic text, that's a very literal rendering in the Septuagint. Feet in the Masoretic text is a sexual, it's a euphemism, you know, for the genitalia. We talked about that in the episode devoted to this. So what it comes down to is this isn't difficult Hebrew. The issue is the Septuagint translator basically does something with the verb in the Masoretic text. It's naga, which means to touch or to reach, as in something's moving towards something and you reach a certain point, strike or approach. And so the translation choice here of a verb in Greek that typically means fall, but could mean embrace or grab or something like that strike, it's still a semantic possibility. Now, you'd say, well, why would the Septuagint translator pick a Greek word that sort of muddies what's going on here? Because a Greek reader is going to be going along here, and the Greek reader is probably going to be thinking just what we see in these English translations of the Septuagint, fell. That's the most common meaning for this Greek verb. Well, I mean, there's a couple ways to think about that. Let's just, you know, try to, you know, we'll speculate here on what's going through the head of the translator. So you have a Jewish person, someone who knows Hebrew, translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek, so they know Greek. They come across this verse. And again, the Hebrew isn't difficult here. You know, Zipporah, you know, takes the flint and she cuts the feet, quote unquote. And the term there, you know, again, is used elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible for the genitals of her son. So she cuts the quote unquote feet of her son. And then she nagah, she touches to his feet, something like that. Well, you could, if you were a sensitive translator, you could look at that and say, let's make a word choice here that doesn't bring out the explicit nature of the genitals. And so in his vocabulary, he comes up with this verb form, pros epesen, which he knows most of his readers are going to look at and read fall, like fall at the feet. And it makes the meaning of the verse ambiguous, and he's good with that because he doesn't want the text to be so explicit. Maybe he thinks that will offend the sensitivity of some of his readers if he really uses Greek to bring out the explicit nature of what's going on here, of a woman. After all, you know, circumcision was supposed to be performed by a priest, by a man. Here you have a woman grabbing her son's genitals and circumcising him. Maybe he thought, you know, that's probably just going to really irritate or offend or shock some readers. So I'm going to obscure the point by the Greek word I choose here. And the ones who sort of know, they're the wiser, they're going to see how what I'm doing here. They're going to see how the word could give off that meaning, could transmit that meaning. But they're also, you know, most of the readers, they're going to read right over it and not see that. Kind of like we do in English, you know, because we read feet when we really, if we translate it according to meaning, you know, we would do something explicit like genitals. Okay. So could the Septuagint translator actually be doing what the English translators do with this? Is really what it comes down to. And I think, yeah, you know, that's not unreasonable to think. Because we do it in English, we obscure the explicit nature of it in English, and maybe they did that in Greek. They just chose to do it with the verb and then translate the, you know, potos, you know, for, you know, what's going on here. And, you know, their readers, if they catch the double meaning, well, they'll know what I'm doing with the verb. If they don't catch the double meaning, well, that's fine. Then they can have Zipporah falling at the feet of somebody, and arguably Moses, you know, and that's okay because, you know, a woman falling at a man's feet, you know, in sort of a subservient, you know, kind of cultural mode, that's not going to surprise anybody. So, yeah, we're good. We're good now. I think that is actually pretty likely in this passage because the Septuagint follows everything else here, you know, pretty closely. So that would be my judgment, that we have a translator trying to not be explicit in translation and yet still sort of be in the ballpark.
All right, Mike, and just like that, we're done.
Just like that, we're done.
Just like that.
Right.
Done with part one, only two more parts to go.
Two more parts to go. A lot of questions, yep. These are good questions.
All right, we're good.
Yeah.
All right, well, we want to thank everybody who sent in those questions, and we want to thank you, Mike, for answering those questions, and we want to thank everybody else in the wide world of planet Earth for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.